Jesus save.
Mormon Mental Health is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards supporting its listeners. To support the podcast, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. And thanks for listening.
Jordan, come.
Hello, and welcome to a special collaborative episode of A Thoughtful Faith and Mormon Mental Health. My name is Micah Nicolaisen, and I will be your host today. And I am very pleased to have with me two awesome Mormon women, Natasha Helfer-Parker and Jennifer Finlayson-Fife. Natasha and Jennifer, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Natasha Helfer-Parker is the host and manager of the Mormon Mental Health podcast, and we have been discussing over the previous weeks that it'd be great to do a collaboration. And the topic for our episode tonight is the psychological concept of cognitive dissonance and how it relates to things like faith crisis and Mormonism and all that good stuff. And so that is going to be what we are going to tackle tonight. And fortunately, we could not have two better experts than Natasha and Jennifer to address this issue. And so I'd like both of you to sort of introduce yourselves to our audience for those. I'm sure most of our audience is already familiar with both of you. But Natasha, if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself, and then Jennifer, if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about yourself as well, that'd be great.
Great. Let's see. I am a marriage and family therapist, and I've been practicing for about 15 years. I'm in private practice currently. And I write a blog called The Mormon Therapist, which is kind of advice column format for questions for Mormons to be able to ask anonymously. And I also, do podcasts and do some writings. And I'm excited to be here today.
And I'm Jennifer Finlayson-Fife, and I live outside of Chicago and married with three kids. And I'm a therapist also in private practice, and wrote my dissertation on Mormon women and sexuality. And so I work primarily with married couples, and often people contact me because of my specialty in sexual issues. So and I also do quite a few podcasts and teach classes both online and here in the Chicago area. So I'm glad to be here.
Perfect. Thank you both for being here and for giving that introduction. So I want to just kind of introduce sort of why, at least for myself, why I think this the concept and theory of cognitive dissonance is an appropriate topic for this podcast. Several years ago, my introduction to the concept of cognitive dissonance came when I read a book called Shaken Faith Syndrome by Michael Ash, who is he's a contributor to FAIR and has a blog, and I'll put a link up on our website. And it was in this this book that I was introduced to the concept of cognitive dissonance and how it relates to sort of having issues, being introduced to troubling aspects of Mormon history and doctrine and things like that. And actually, I think Mike Ash did a really good job of sort of giving a rough overview of it. And later on later in my life, a couple of years later, when I was sort of going through my own faith transition, a lot of the things I learned about cognitive dissonance were very helpful to me in sort of navigating that and sort of understanding psychologically what was going on inside my head. And it really, I think, helped me in a very healthy way sort of manage my faith crisis and faith transition. And so I think in terms of A Thoughtful Faith and sort of the goals and objectives that we have as a podcast, I think it'd be really great to sort of address this topic and discuss it and how it relates to Mormonism. I think it'd be beneficial for many people in our audience, and really for everybody. I think it's something that everybody should become familiar with. So that is why we are talking about it. And so before we really start talking about Mormonism We want to first sort of go through the concept of cognitive dissonance and sort of understand it, where it comes from, so on and so forth. And so to start off, we wanted to just kind of go through the clinical definition of cognitive dissonance and what it is. And so, Jennifer, if you wouldn't mind kind of sharing us your thoughts of what cognitive dissonance is, that'd be great.
Sure. So probably a lot of people have a basic sense of it. I mean, I think I actually learned about cognitive dissonance in my Psych 101 class at BYU. But basically, cognitive dissonance is this the state of having, you know, inconsistency between your thoughts and attitudes, essentially, and your behaviors. And whenever there's this discrepancy between what you're doing and what you believe, or a discrepancy between what you believe and what you're experiencing, that it produces a feeling of discomfort. And that discomfort, you know, the human tendency is to want to compress that discrepancy or get rid of that discrepancy. And so, you know, oftentimes that dissonance pressures us to reconcile those two by either changing our beliefs to fit with our behaviors or our experience, even if that shift in belief is illogical or maladaptive, or to shift either shift our beliefs or to shift what data we'll take in. And Festinger was a theorist researcher who out of a participant observation study that he did in 1945, developed the theory of cognitive dissonance. The study that he was involved in was looking at a cult who believed that the world was going to be destroyed by a flood. And, you know, the theory emerged out of what he observed in that is that when they in fact found out that it wasn't going to be destroyed on this particular day, that the more fringy members of the cult, the ones who were kind of less devout, essentially gave up their beliefs and, you know, chalked it up to experience. But the ones that were the most devout, you know, the ones that had actually given up their homes and work for the sake of their beliefs of the cult, the most devout ones were unwilling to give up their commitment to the cult. And so what they did was they basically reinterpreted their experience in order to affirm those beliefs, such as, you know, the flood didn't happen because of our great faith, you know, because of the faith of the cult members that we basically fended this off. And so out of that research, Festinger proposed this idea that the greater the discomfort, you know, then the greater the desire there is to reduce that discrepancy. And so, again, we'll either change our beliefs to fit with our actions and experience, or we'll change our actions or experience to fit with our beliefs.
Cool. Very cool. Natasha, anything you want to add to that?
One thing I'll add to that is it also can be just between beliefs, you know, so even not necessarily attached to behavior. If you have two belief systems that seem to be contrary to each other, that can cause this discomfort that Jennifer's talking about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to just even explain a little bit further, as far as people who, you know, have sold their homes or who are really involved, it is kind of a sense of investment. However much invested you are in those ideas or those behaviors or those values, then the harder it's going to be to kind of change course. Because the changing course can elicit other feelings like embarrassment or discomfort or shame or anxiety, or even just one of my favorite words, which is ambiguity, the unknown. You know, so we don't like the unknown. It's not a comfortable place for most of us. That's just kind of human tendency. And just also to just normalize this a little bit is, you know, since we're born, our brain is organizing information and labeling things and putting things into compartments so that we can make sense of the world. And so it's not abnormal to have cognitions and values and kind of ways of thinking about things. It's when those things are challenged by new information that this tension arises.
Right. Yeah, I remember when I read Mike Ash's book, the way he sort of explained it is that there's all these thousands or even millions of cognitions that are sort of floating around in your mind or compartmentalized in your brain. And each one of them has a different weight, and which goes along to what you were saying, Natasha, the level of investment, you know, determines how much weight a cognition has in your mind. And that cognition could be something like a religious belief. It could be a political belief. It could be anything, really. And your brain can't hold two opposing cognitions of the same weight at the same time. And that's when that disharmony or that dissonance happens. And that's sort of the theory of cognitive dissonance. How well accepted is this concept, you know, in your experience in sort of the field of psychology? Like, what's your experience or understanding of it?
Yeah, I think it's a very well accepted concept. I mean, I think it's a little bit hard to prove because you can't see cognitive dissonance, but I think that, you know, there's a lot of research that's been done on the concept. It's certainly a part of the crises that often bring people in for therapy. So I think it's a well-accepted part of the human experience.
But I would agree with that.
Okay, cool. So in terms of examples that we can sort of pull from, like, day-to-day life, are there any – because I think it's, you know, to kind of help – sort of understand exactly what we're talking about here. What are some day-to-day examples of cognitive dissonance? Natasha, would you mind providing us with some thoughts there?
Well, there's hundreds and thousands of examples we could probably come up with. A very classic one is the little white lie. So in other words, you know, if your values include being honest, and, you know, telling the truth, which is kind of a common value that people have, then it's difficult when, you know, somebody asks you, well, does my hair look nice today? Or do you like my new clothing? Or, you know, just simple things like that. And in order to not hurt somebody's feelings, you may say, oh, sure, I love it, even though I don't, you know, I love your cooking, even though I don't. So that's kind of a very simple kind of example. Jennifer, you shared a great example with us from your son's perspective the other day.
So something I would say is, like, when you say to somebody that you like the color of their shirt or whatever, I mean, then you justify your lie by saying, I don't want to hurt their feelings. So that's a way of sort of bridging the discrepancy between I'm somebody who's honest and I just lied, is that you then shift your belief and say, well, in this situation, so this is not to your point, Natasha, about what I'll tell you about in a second, but, or, like, you know, you steal office supplies. Well, that's incongruent with your belief that you shouldn't steal, but then you justify it by saying, I'm not paid enough, or they're a large company and nobody cares. So that's where you – that's the moment of where you're trying to get rid of the dissonance between your behavior and your beliefs. But, yeah, earlier when we had a conversation, I was mentioning that my oldest child, who's on the autism spectrum, he has a hard time with what I should say is, he really likes to organize the world and to feel very much that data is sort of compartmentalized into certain places, and this actually gives him a sense of comfort. And so when he was about 7 years old, I remember saying to him that peanuts were not nuts, they were actually legumes. And he just was like, oh, what? You know, you can see, like, he's grabbing his head, the stress that's coming over him. He's like, yes, they are. Peanuts are nuts. They're nuts. And, you know, I could just see his whole body, like, going, coming overwhelmed. And so I'm there, you know, Graham, it's okay. They're legumes. It's okay, Graham. You know, they're not nuts. They're legumes for these reasons and so on. And you see him just, like, kind of falling apart. And then he gets his breathing under control. And by the end, you know, 5 or 10 minutes later, he's like, okay, peanuts are legumes. You know, so he made the adjustment. He went through the very stressful process of having to shift his beliefs, his worldview. But, you know, that's kind of it in a moment.
In a nutshell.
Exactly.
Well, nice. That's a fun story because it involves a small child, right? But you can see very similar reactions as far as the intensity of the emotion with current themes in our culture. You know, I mean, gun control is a very hot topic these days. pro-choice, pro-life movements are very hot topics. And you can see that when there's data that's presented to either side, when people have to kind of challenge their own belief systems on these very integral part of their belief system, it's almost like they're having the same type of experience that Jennifer Sun is having, you know,
right.
And really struggling with it almost physically.
Right. And so I've heard people that even say, you know, well, the person that went into the school was, you know, the government put him up to that because they have this objective of having greater gun control. And so this was all, you know, a conspiracy and, you know, to the point of ridiculous that sometimes people will adhere to ideas that are hard to support in order to not have to challenge their worldview. So,
right. So, one example that I always like to share is, you know, if you grew up your whole life being told and thinking that your grandma has the best fried chicken recipe in the world and nobody makes better fried chicken than your grandmother, and then one day that is challenged, you will feel cognitive dissonance over something like that as well. You know, it's something that sort of humans deal with all the time. If either of you were to describe cognitive dissonance in terms of what it feels like what are some common sort of symptoms, for lack of a better word, for cognitive dissonance? Like, what do people experience when they have it?
Well, I think the best probably word to describe it is anxiety.
Yeah.
And that can encompass a lot of things like fear and shame or embarrassment. It can feel, you know, you can feel heated inside, like flushed, like you're turning red. You can feel nauseous even, because maybe something's almost like hitting you in the gut, like you have to rethink something so difficult for you to do. There's probably all kinds, you know, racing heartbeat. Do you want to add?
Yeah,
more
no,
to
that's
that?
Exactly the word that came into my head was anxiety. I think it's sometimes painful, you know, disorienting, frightening. I mean, it just depends on, you know, how important the particular issue is, and especially around, you know, worldview crises, faith, you know, faith crises, crises in a sense of who you are as a person, what your marriage is, you know, things that really matter to you. Those are going to be much more anxiety evoking than the smaller discrepancies and so on.
So it can be something that can be resolved within, you know, a few minutes, and it can be something that can be resolved over 10 years, you know, so
right.
Depending on how serious, you know, some people can have clinical depressive episodes, you know, attached to these types of things, or, you know, develop generalized anxiety disorder. Other people, you know, within half an hour, they've kind of figured something out and move on. So
right.
Again, depending on how serious, how serious it is in their life and what the implications are.
Right. And one of the things that I was reading about is that basically people that have greater anxiety tolerance do better with cognitive dissonance. They have more ability to tolerate it, to kind of observe it and learn from it. And people who generally have higher anxiety are much more, like my son, are much more distressed by the dissonance, that they want a sense of structure and certainty. And I would maybe even argue that the more you sort of demand that, then often the less well you'll adapt to the new data, and I think in some ways cause yourself more anxiety ultimately. But I think some people are more disposed to manage those discrepancies better than others are.
Which goes back to a lot of our different strengths and weaknesses is a human race. Some of us are more structured naturally, although that can become problematic when we become rigid. And then some of us are more flexible, but that can become problematic if we become chaotic. And so there's this kind of ongoing balancing between these strengths and weaknesses that we have, and depending on where you are on the spectrum can have a lot to do with how mentally stable and emotionally stable you are.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Yeah. So, you know, from what both of you are describing, you know, in terms of a sort of a clinical theory, it sounds, I hear the way that people sort of define and approach cognitive dissonance sounds very similar to how people frame the theory of evolution, where, you know, there isn't a lot of, like, you know, definitive proof that evolution is real, but evolution as a concept explains a lot of natural phenomena that is observable in the world. And it seems like the same thing applies to cognitive dissonance. You know, a lot of the reactions and behavior that humans have, both healthy and unhealthy, and it seems like cognitive dissonance is something that can be a really useful model in terms of understanding some of those things.
Yes.
And, you know, based on what you said about sort of how it feels when you have cognitive dissonance, it's no wonder that our brains want to get rid of that feeling as quickly as possible. You know, and this may be a little bit difficult to sort of approach here, but what are some sort of common ways that, you know, our minds and our what are some common ways that we try to mitigate or to resolve cognitive dissonance?
Well, I'll just say some quick things because I think Jennifer already touched on this somewhat. But one is, if you have two different belief systems, you change one so that it's consistent with the other. If you have two cognitions that you don't want to necessarily give up, then you add more to create a storyline between them all. Or you alter importance. So in other words, you kind of, like Jennifer's example of, so I'm telling a white lie, even though I'm honest, but the importance is focused on not hurting somebody's feelings. So those are kind of some basic ways. And Jennifer, you can add to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one that I think is that we do is something that psychologists refer to as confirmation bias. And so when we really adhere to a framework or a way of thinking that we value or that helps us kind of make sense of our lives, then we will not take in data that disconfirms that particular perspective. So we'll kind of blind ourselves to the data that would throw that discrepancy, make that discrepancy evident. And so we look for things that affirm what we want to believe, and we ignore things that disconfirm it.
It is very difficult to change a person's mind about many of the topics we've discussed, politics, religion,
right,
social issues,
right, particularly the more invested we are, as you said, Natasha, and particularly the more that they have kind of helped us frame our lives. Because I think, you know, this tendency that we have as human beings is not, you know, in some ways when we talk about it, we think of it as like this negative thing. It sort of shows how dishonest we are as a species and so on. But what I would say is I think it's really a valuable tool in some ways to kind of narrow the field, to want to shift to a worldview, to want to find a framework, because there's just too much data to take in. There's too much to make sense of, and we're meaning-making creatures by nature. And so the desire to make sense of it and to kind of commit to a certain framework or commit to a certain set of people, I think that's actually beneficial and adaptive. It actually allows us to enter into the world in a more functional way. We're able to start, you know, being productive and making choices and, you know, moving forward rather than constantly trying to figure out what we think and what we feel. So it's actually adaptive to do it. When it becomes maladaptive, I think, is when it becomes too rigid, when we won't let it be altered, when we want it to stand irrespective of whatever data is challenging it, because what we start doing then is undermining our ability to actually develop a useful framework or, you know, a functional roadmap, as it were, because we're not letting in important information.
Gotcha. So, you know, what I gather from that is that cognitive dissonance isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just a natural thing that occurs. What can be sort of healthy or unhealthy is how we personally choose to deal with it. And there's sort of extremes, you know, in terms of, you know, how much we shelter ourselves from outside information that conflicts with our, you know, deeply held and cherished ways to look at the world. Sometimes that can be be harmful. And then on the other hand, as you mentioned, Jennifer, we can't just sort of suspend belief about everything so that we're, you know, so that we're not, anyway. So,
If we can drive in any two concepts today, like 500 times, it would be that A, labeling is normal, and that, yes, you know, that we organize information and that we fall into biases and fall into kind of, you know, cultural norms. That's a normal part of being a human being. And B, cognitive dissonance is normal because we're going to be challenged, you know, by how we have organized our things in every single facet of our lives. So those two kind of opposing principles are going to be constant in our lives, and they're both normal, and we can expect them, and
they're
we
both
can normalize them.
Right. And I think that, and they're both functional. I mean, at least potentially functional. So, you know, it's like, I really feel like
potentially dysfunctional.
Exactly. It can be both, but you know, it's like, I feel like my life is better for making a commitment to one man, for making a commitment to be invested in my children, to making a commitment to be invested in my Mormonism and in my Mormon community, that in some ways it's like my life is better for having kind of narrowed the field and sort of said, this is where I'm going to put my most of my energy. So I absolutely think my life would be worse off if I weren't actually kind of labeling and categorizing and making decisions about where I was going to sort of be focused. But then I think, as you're saying, you know, it's useful to kind of lift your head up once in a while and say, are these commitments still worthy? Do they still make sense? Am I really staying honest in my focus and my commitments? So,
along with that is kind of the concept of becoming enlightened. And most of us, when we have that experience, whether we see that as an intellectual process or a spiritual process through the Holy Ghost or however we want to frame that, it's usually a new idea. You know, it's usually something that we haven't thought of before. We haven't thought of it quite in that way. And so, just like what you're saying, Jennifer, it's really healthy to have a focus. It's also very healthy to look up and look around and, you know, see things in a new light.
Absolutely.
Cool. So before we tie this all into Mormonism, is there anything we need to sort of address with cognitive dissonance sort of in a general sense before we talk about Mormonism?
One thing I'll say is, I guess before we get into Mormonism specifically, is piggybacking on a lot of what Jennifer has said, but how we choose to resolve cognitive dissonance oftentimes reflects our general mental health. I think we've already said that. But it's important to also kind of recognize that it is a tool for growth. And if we stay in rigid places, then we can really kind of damage our ability to grow. And so I just want to put that at the beginning of starting the Mormon discussion.
Right.
Cool. So both of you, from what I've gathered, a lot of your patients are LDS people. Is that safe to say?
Yes.
About 90% of mine.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you both, you know, have the opportunity to sort of see how cognitive dissonance can manifest itself with LDS people. Are there any specific examples that you'd like to share that can sort of help us frame, you know, some examples of how this can apply to Mormon culture and a Mormon belief system?
Yeah, I think I have the experience often of people coming in a particular crisis, and often it's a crisis in their marriage or a crisis in their life outside of their marriage. Sometimes it's around a crisis of faith, but usually that's more of a secondary issue that comes into my office. But there's often this experience that sort of what I've been taught is going to give me a happy life is not giving me a happy life. So one of the themes is around, I work with a lot of LDS women, and you know, I've been taught that if I was virtuous and good and did all these things in this way and then got married, that everything was going to work out right and I was going to be happy. And if we got married in the temple and so on, and you know, he was a good priesthood holder, that that was kind of the ticket into a happy life. And oftentimes people are coming in disillusioned because they found out their husband's having an affair, or he's addicted to pornography, or that there's some kind of crisis in this idea. Maybe sometimes they're just depressed and overwhelmed and feeling like they've done all that they should do, but they have no joy. And, you know, often they're trying to sort out this discrepancy between here's the ideal that I've embraced and what I'm experiencing, and where's the problem? Either I'm the problem or the ideal is the problem. Which one is it? And, you know, a lot of times people come in feeling lots of feelings of guilt and shame and inadequacy because somehow I'm still not happy, even though, you know, so something must be wrong with me. Everybody else seems to have it together. Or they're coming in and saying, you know, I don't know if I believe this because it is not really matching up with my experience of my life or of my marriage or whatever it is. So there's often this struggle between either one of these things has to give. Is it that I'm wrong, or my framework is maladaptive or not adequate? So,
well, and I totally second everything she has just said. And this goes back to the investment issues. My experience is that usually the more active and really invested members can be so very hard on themselves because it can't be the system. Yes. They're so invested, you know, in their testimonies, and they just dedicate their entire lives to the church and are really wonderful people doing wonderful things. So therefore, if there's a problem, it can't be, you know, the church or the organization or what they see as God's program for happiness. It's got to be me. So that's problematic. At the same time, I don't want to say that, I don't want to imply that there aren't active members who don't start questioning the system, because there are also many dedicated members who do start questioning the system, especially when they're educated on things such as mental health issues and how that affects this kind of equational happiness formula that we tend to throw out there so often. And so, you know, you can start having questions, and then again, the more invested you are, the harder that crash can feel if you start questioning the structure, because you did put your whole faith and your whole life and, you know, even decisions that you've made, you know, like your marriage and missions and monies that have been paid to tithings, you know, all of that is a huge investment in this lifestyle, and that can feel extremely excruciating to start questioning.
Yes.
Gotcha. So one way that, or I shouldn't say one way, one of the ways that we can, as Mormons, experience cognitive dissonance is when the sort of prescribed lifestyle and narrative of how we should sort of plan and structure our lives doesn't result in the promised happiness or blessings that we come to expect, right? That can make people feel really depressed or anxious, or, you know, have those sort of symptoms of cognitive dissonance in their lives.
Right. Yes.
Okay. That's really good, and I think really helpful. I think that's a useful framework. Let's talk specifically about faith crises. And obviously everybody has different experiences and different catalysts for their faith crisis, and many of them may be the very things that we're talking about, you know, in terms of, you know, I went on a mission, I got married in the temple, I do this, I do that, and that's not working out. That can be something that catalyzes a crisis of faith. Other common catalysts will include things like being exposed to sort of troubling historical or doctrinal issues that may conflict with the established expectation for those things. What I'm trying to sort of ask is, what sort of is the process that happens psychologically with cognitive dissonance when that process starts.
Historical perspective, I think we do ourselves a disservice, I think, when we talk about, I guess, our church, what do I say, I guess the package, as it's either all true or it's all false. And you will hear that even, recently over the pulpit. And I think the reason why that does a disservice is because it doesn't allow for ambiguity, and history is complicated and chaotic in of itself. Truth is complicated and chaotic, and it's very much through the eyes of the beholder kind of process. And so when you lay it out as it's either all true or all false, you kind of set people up for cognitive dissonance.
Yes.
And that's a problem if we want to keep our members, comfortable, or at least more comfortable with some of the issues that we have in our past.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is what you're asking exactly, Micah, or not, but I agree. I think that in many ways, because we are so focused on an authoritative structure in the church and being the true church, that we have, I think, simplified the narrative around what truth is and how you know you're in it, meaning there's a lot of pressure for conformity in a way that I think was not the case when, back in Joseph Smith's time or, in the early church. And so there's a lot of conformity pressure, people standing up and saying these are the four elements of a real testimony. All the rest is useless. just things right. like that where you can only, if you don't fit in this box, there's something wrong with you. And while that can give the impression of clarity and truthfulness and sort of a singular standard of, what we're about, I fully agree with what Natasha is saying, that it really does set us up. It pressures the cognitive dissonance issue much more. And I remember at a certain point in my life feeling like I was expending a lot of energy trying to get everything to fit into the box, to get all my experience to fit in, and doing a lot of this, like trying to make the meaning, make it work. And because I was just somebody who wanted some sense of integrity in my belief, I just really wanted to feel like that it really fit for me and that I could include as much data as possible. And I think I felt that more than maybe other people did, and my peers anyway. And I remember just at a certain point knowing that I was deceiving myself, that I was actively being dishonest to try and make it all fit. And that recognition was in and of itself too uncomfortable for me. Like, I couldn't sit with that anymore, because I just recognized I was trying to deceive myself into belief, and that I just couldn't believe in a God who would support that. So it shifted how I started looking at my experience.
Right. Well, I really appreciate you sharing that, Jennifer, that sort of personal experience. Natasha, are there any specific examples from your own life with Mormonism where you sort of went through this process?
As therapists, we're very privileged to be welcomed into many people's stories. And so I think that's been an extra challenge in a sense for me when it comes to cognitive dissonance, because I know I not only had to deal with my own story and how it fit, in the structure and paradigm of Mormonism, but I'm having to deal with, all kinds of other people's stories who are trying to make that same fit, that are coming from very different situations than mine. And so, and I can see the genuineness and the sincerity of that journey and of that struggle from people's experiences that differ from me. I mean, from at the core, for instance, homosexuality. I mean, I'm not a homosexual. And all of a sudden I was having to be involved in the story of homosexual members and their families in ways that were very intimate. And like I said, it was a privilege. And yet it struck me to the core as far as cognitive dissonance, especially, when I first started, which was 20 years ago, where the church hadn't yet come out with certain statements that it's come out with today. And, you know, where I had heard many different opposing views, you know, in my place of education, which was Brigham Young University. And so those are all things that I had to sit and ponder and, you know, pray about and meditate about and just really have very interesting discussions within my own brain about, to come to some of the conclusions that I've come up with, you know, for myself at this point in my life. And I'm sure that will continue to change, you know, as more knowledge progresses. So it's, I think there's so many different, experiences. And I think, you know, one thing that Jennifer said is what is this God that I believe in? Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Mormonism, we have this really kind of neat paradigm that we can have a personal relationship with God, and that God is loving, and that God wants us to progress, and that God wants us to find meaning in life and to find joy in life. And so when the same principles, or maybe not principles, but maybe guidelines or structures or rules or rites of passage seem to not fall in line for some people in the church that leads to joy and progress, then that is an automatic cause for cognitive dissonance. So, you know, like Jennifer's example, when you get married to in the temple to the returned missionary, and all, you know, and all of a sudden you can't have a positive sexual experience with that person, or you can't seem to find joy together, you know, that's a struggle. That's a struggle. It doesn't fit the promises or the blessings that we thought were part of those decisions. And so I think that that's the question I come back to a lot, even with my clients, is who is this God that you worship, and what is he or she about for you? And many times I think what happens is that if the God that we formulate in our own minds, you know, because our experience with God is very personal, and so it's going to be different for everybody. If that picture no longer jives with our current experiences, then that's a problem, and we need to work through that problem. And it's a personal conversion, and people can deal with that, I think, in one of three ways, but I'm sure there is more. One is to say, well, then God doesn't exist because God wouldn't do this to me, or to us, or to humans. Another way we can deal with that, and these are examples of cognitive dissonance, is, well, we don't understand his or her ways, so I'll just, you know, muddle along because I'm going to have faith and trust that someday I will understand, because I'm, you know, I'm a mortal being and I'm not meant to understand in this lifetime. Another way we can have cognitive dissonance is to say, well, the scriptures are just written by imperfect men, and they didn't quite capture the essence of God. Yeah, so those are kind of some examples, and you guys can probably come up with some more, but how we start to reformulate who Heavenly Father, who Heavenly Mother are to us.
Right. Which I think is just a part of spiritual development too, because I think, you know, it's even in our theology very much the idea that one of the purposes of life is to come to know who God is, which I don't think means, you know, okay, well, he's white, you know, white beard, white. I mean, it's about like, what are God's characteristics and qualities? And the way you come to know them is through living it, through your own evolution as a person, through coming to know, you know, gain experience and wisdom, and to come to be a more loving, solid human being. And so I think that that is part of our thinking, is that we do need to evolve, and that we're all immature spiritually, and immature people, spiritually immature people, are teaching each other about God, but are often more reflections of the way we see the world rather than the way the world is, meaning, you know, that's so often what we reflect and what we talk about is really more a reflection of ourselves than it is about what really is. you know, I do see in my own practice that often there's an evolution in people's way of thinking about their faith and their notions of what is true and who God is. And many people are still able to fully find that within Mormonism. They just have a different and a wiser understanding of the teachings than what they held beforehand.
Gotcha. So, you know, if I were to sort of try to summarize the discussion we just had, it's easy for religious people and particularly Mormons to sort of have a crisis of faith and to feel cognitive dissonance when, first of all, there is almost a false dichotomy presented. You know, it's either all true or it's all false, or an oversimplification, like you said, the four, you know, elements of a real testimony. When you're sort of, there are sort of these maybe unrealistic premises that are given to us, combined with when our expectation doesn't match the reality that we experience, whether it's in our marriages, whether it's in the level of spirituality we feel, or when we are have an expectation of our history or our doctrine that doesn't, that becomes threatened by the exposure to new information or information that contradicts that. But what I also hear you saying, hear you both saying, is that this is a good thing, you know, that this is something that, that allows us and helps us to grow as human beings. And I would add to that by saying, you know, if one of the reasons that we're here on this earth from a very Mormon narrative and perspective is to gain experience, to deal with mortality, cognitive dissonance must be an important part of that, human condition and what we're meant to learn and grow from here.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, using Jennifer's word reframe, I oftentimes, not to minimize a faith crisis, because it can very much feel like a crisis, but oftentimes I reframe that word into a faith transition, because I do think that transitions are part of normal life, just like developmental stages are part of normal life. You know, we have childhood, we have adolescence, we have young adulthood, we have middle age adulthood, we have elderly people, you know, so each stage of life comes with its own developmental norms and things that we're supposed to be experiencing at that time. And even brain differences, you know, developmental brain parts of that. And so faith transitions are very similar. I believe very much that conversions are continually part of our story, and that we convert our sense of belief and faith and spirituality almost on a weekly to monthly to yearly basis if we want to, you know, if we want to challenge ourselves in that way. And like Jennifer said, I think that's a very healthy approach.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think the more honestly you grapple with those discrepancies, the more adaptively you navigate them. Because, you know, for example, you can sort of reduce the dissonance in a simple-minded way, but dishonest way, and reduce the anxiety quickly, but then maladaptively. So, for example, if you're who you think you are and what you claim as an ideal are discrepant, like we said, you can make it as this is all about me. I'm the failure, you know, I'm the loser because I haven't been able to make this work. Or the other way you can do it is say it's all about my ideal. It's all about the church, for example. So let's say you believe you should be chaste until marriage and then you are not. Well, then a dishonest way of resolving that would just be to say, well, the church isn't true, obviously, because I don't want to think of myself as a failure, and therefore I'll just give up the framework completely. And so those are both dishonest, what I would think of as dishonest ways of managing the discrepancy, for at least for some people, because they're not taking into account the other data that pushes them to sort of face something they don't want to face. So for the person who wants to make it all about themselves, they're maybe too anxious about dealing with that the framework may not be perfect, that the framework may not be able to answer all things for me, and I would rather see myself as a failure than have to challenge the framework that has guided my life, so I will take the hit. or the person who says, I just want to give up the framework completely because it's too uncomfortable for me to think of myself as having failed at something that I value. So I'm just going to manage it by saying I no longer value it. And I'm not saying that people can't change what they value, obviously, but am I approaching that honestly, or am I doing it reactively, but it maladaptively?
And being aware of your own cognitive dissonance, I think, can be helpful to help you check yourself. Like, why am I feeling this way? Am I experiencing cognitive dissonance, and how am I dealing with it? And so I think the whole reason I wanted to address this topic with our podcast, because I think just being aware of cognitive dissonance and being aware of your own sort of, and things like confirmation bias and the, you know, thousands of other cognitive biases we use to minimize cognitive dissonance, I think is really helpful to keep ourselves in check and making sure that our motivations are pure and that we are being honest with ourselves.
Yes.
Yeah, and what Jennifer's describing in layman's terms is really all or nothing thinking, black and white thinking. I mean, we hear those terms, you know, often in our day-to-day life. And that type of thinking can happen in the church. It can happen outside of the church. It can happen, you know, all over the place. So it is really that sense of the more mature we become, the more comfortable we are kind of living in the gray, which is not necessarily a concept we're culturally very comfortable with within Mormonism. Yes. And so I think that that's a challenge that we all have, is to recognize that that gray is a legitimate color. I've heard it said that black and white, you know, are, or what was it? Oh yeah. I heard that if you look at a newspaper, you know, the gray shades, if you really pull them out, they're made of black and white, to kind of dismiss the gray. But I stand clear that gray is a legitimate color.
Or another way that I think about that, Natasha, is it's not that you can't still, you're still very much in pursuit of truth. You're just not willing to take simple-minded positions to arrive at truth quickly. And so, like, sometimes political discussions drive me bananas because I feel like they are so much about their turf battles. They're so tribal. There's so much about identity and sort of like, I want this framework to answer all questions. And people have a very hard time sort of stepping in, really saying open to like, what do we think is honestly the best solution for the most people? And can we be flexible about it? And I just think that takes a kind of emotional maturity. And I don't think it's like letting go of what's true. It's more around, can we really think about what's going to actually be adaptive and helpful, and can I be flexible enough in my own thinking to really pursue what I think is best or most right? And I think it's not so much that, you know, gray, I think why people get upset about gray is they think it's like immoral or amoral. You know, it's not about actually taking a position. Where I think it's more around, I'm trying to take a more reasoned and grounded position that is more inclusive and isn't so fear driven.
Right. One thing we wanted to make sure we addressed are kind of two sides of the same coin. And this is specifically talking about people who become exposed to troubling history. I remember, I was having a conversation actually with a ward member of mine. And this was, after I had decided to become a lot more public about my own sort of unique approach to Mormonism. And during this conversation with this ward member, he expressed to me, when I read that stuff, and when he said that stuff, you know, I think he was referring to basically uncorrelated history, or probably what he considered to be anti-Mormon literature. He said, when I read that stuff, it makes me feel sick to my stomach. And that right there was enough to tell me that this wasn't coming from God, that this was coming from another source. And it was interesting, and I think it's probably very common for a lot of people when they sort of start to grapple with cognitive dissonance. I think when I say people, and I mean specifically Mormons, I think it's very common for us to attribute those sort of dark, almost depressive feelings to something that isn't pointing us to truth, and so we sort of dismiss it as coming from Satan. Would either of you want to respond to that notion or that sort of paradigm?
I guess I would just say that's a handy response in the sense that it certainly makes it easier to simplify the world and to say my discomfort is just about that it means it's dark. And I understand that desire to frame it up as that. I think the question I would have is, you know, how honest is it? Do you really, really feel clear that it's from Satan, or is it more like it's reactive, impulsive, and I want very much to put it there, so I'm going to? I think people say sometimes that, you know, people that leave the church are less happy than people that stay in. I mean, what I would say to that is sometimes there's probably truth in that, but that sometimes that's also because it's easier to believe in a very, I'm not saying the church is a simple framework, but I'm saying if people can kind of hold very simple frames, it offers a kind of comfort that we all want, right? The question is, how honest is it, and at what cost? What are we not willing to integrate? And if we're not, I take very seriously the idea that the truth shall set us free. And in many ways, I feel like that's very much a product of my growing up in the church. And so I really believe in the truth in the sense that I'm in pursuit of it always, even when it's uncomfortable. And so I think sometimes we want to just say, well, anything that's sort of outside of what makes me comfortable is therefore an evil, as opposed to if I'm going to become like God, I have to have the courage to be able to look at information and to bring wisdom and reasoned responses to it and to make good decisions about it. I can't just narrow my field so that I don't have to deal with any of it or grow up around any of it or mature around these ideas. So anyway, I guess I understand why somebody wants to go there because it simplifies things, but I don't know that it's really useful.
Well, this idea of emotion being tied to truth is also tricky.
Yeah.
Because you know, we do read in the scriptures, you know, that truth will feel a certain way. You know, we all kind of have our own interpretation of what it feels to have a spiritual experience or to have, answers given to us by heavenly hosts, you know, whether that's the Holy Ghost or Heavenly Father, however you think of that. And so, you know, I run into this a lot with clients is, you know, they may have very different ideas or values or ways to understand their faith. But then they have a hard time knowing what to do with all the experiences that they once saw through a certain lens. And so that is tricky because we do tie, again, we make connections, right? And so I have this emotional experience. I want to know what it means. I'm in this social construct that tells me this is what it means. And so I kind of add up all those, you know, or connect the dots and I come up with this great story, which oftentimes can be shared over a testimony meeting pulpit. And I'm not saying that to minimize that because I think that those are valid experiences and those are valid constructs, but it doesn't mean they can't be constructed in different ways. Or if you hadn't been born in a different culture or a different society or different family even, that you would have construed those even slightly differently, even within Mormonism. So it does get complicated when we look at emotion and cognition and how we tie those two together.
Yes. You know, for me, I think it's value. That's why I think it's so valuable for everybody to be informed about, you know, these sort of factors that are going on in the way we process information, you know, because for somebody like me, you know, now that I understand what cognitive dissonance is, at least as, you know, as much as a guy like me can, if I have that feeling of anxiety or nausea, you know, maybe 5 years ago, I would have been like, yeah, oh, this is Satan. This is Satan influencing me, or this can't be true because it's making me feel this way. But just having a little bit of a higher awareness of our own psychology, I think, is helpful in this situation. And that way we're not closing doors to stuff that could perhaps be leading us to something bigger and better, even though it's uncomfortable. And I'm also thinking of, you know, friends and family members of people who are experiencing a crisis or a transition of their faith. I think it's helpful for people who have loved ones that are going through that experience to understand this as well.
Well, I just think our culture is changing, especially in the historicity type of framework. You can really no longer say, oh, that's an anti-Mormon book, and we have wonderful LDS historians, you know, Richard Bushman. We have wonderful books such as Rough Stone Rolling that will challenge all kinds of aspects of your, you know, kind of, like Jennifer said, simplified narrative that we grew up with in primary. So that is changing. These are respected books. These are books you can now find at Deseret Industries, or not Deseret
Book.
Thank you.
Deseret Book. And so maybe you can find them at DI too. I don't know. anyway, the idea is that we can no longer be like ostriches and putting our heads into the sand. These things are out there. History is, you know, alive and well as far as some of the complexities that we have in our past as a Mormon faith and tradition. And so that isn't really that's not going to fly anymore. That's just anti-Mormon literature. Right. And I'm glad. I'm glad, yeah. Because that really kind of opens us up even more so to these kinds of ideas. And more I'm seeing, you know, even in the Ensign and in other types of publications, I'm seeing references to things that before I think would have been more questionable.
Right. I think sometimes the care and concern that we have for one another should also push us to not just dismiss ideas as being from Satan, that I think if we love one another, we have to be willing to step into their experience and to think about what they're struggling with. And even if we come up with different conclusions, that we're not so afraid that we won't walk beside them.
Yeah, I think it's very common in Mormon culture to treat those with questions and doubts and concerns almost like they're a disease that needs to be cut away from us. But that's not bearing one another's burdens. That's not what we covenant to do with each other. And I think what you're describing is exactly that. Instead of dismissing somebody's concerns, you know, bearing that burden with them is something that we are supposed to do as Latter-day Saints.
Right.
Those opposing principles, you know, there's always kind of the bear each other's burdens, but there's also the, you know, don't let other things influence you in unrighteous ways, you know? And so there's many, many times, and even within gospel teachings, that you're going to find opposing principles. I mean, the Garden of Eden is kind of a classic example. You know, through the Mormon lens, we see that as a very conflicting position that they were in. And so oftentimes there is a choice to be made between two mm-hmm. kind of righteous decisions, in a sense, you know, that you could construe as righteous. And sometimes you're limited in your thoughts or actions because you're somewhat rigid about what is righteous, or one principle wins over another. And that's hard. That's stuff we all have to do kind of on a regular basis, is what principle is going to win out this time and in this situation.
Yeah, I think that's kind of, as you're saying, it's fundamental to life. And I think, you know, ultimately we want our integrity to be what guides us. And oftentimes figuring out what that is, like, where do I stand? What do I really think is right? Meaning I can both understand and care for you and not stand where you stand, not take the position in life that you're taking, but also not have sort of moved away from you just to protect myself or my worldview. Or so is the best in me driving that decision, or is it love and compassion and wisdom that's driving those choices, or is it fear and reactivity?
Well said. I'd like to revisit kind of this idea of justifying or rationalizing behavior, because that is a big part of cognitive dissonance. And I think, Jennifer, you spoke to it well when you said, are people honestly coming by their decisions as to what they're going to dismiss or value in their life? But I do think that this is a bias that we within Mormon culture do kind of throw out, in the sense that if we see people struggling, or if we just kind of assume that
obviously they're disobeying.
Well, the only reason why he no longer or she no longer comes to church is because instead of facing the harder questions, our way to have cognitive dissonance would be to say, well, it's not that there's actual historical issues that, you know, that I might have to face someday. It's because they wanted to, I don't know, go out and have coffee, you know, or they wanted to have some alcohol, or, and especially if we see them doing some of those things, you know, because as people move away from kind of our faith tradition, they may no longer have some of the values that we have, especially around kind of what I would consider more simplistic things like coffee or alcohol. If we see them behaving in that way, we may completely minimize their entire experience and just say, well, this is only because that's what they wanted to do.
Right.
And that can be very, I think, harmful, especially in family relationships when you have that type of view of one another.
Earlier, I mentioned two sides of the same coin. And what I was sort of alluding to there is, you know, from people who are very orthodox and, for lack of a better word, mainstream, they can sort of react to cognitive dissonance and sort of attribute it to Satan. But on the other side, I think for those who are very informed about what cognitive dissonance is, and this is actually something, Natasha, that you mentioned before we started recording, is, you know, they can sort of attribute a lot of the spiritual experiences and testimonies that people have and almost be dismissive of it and tack it up to people just managing cognitive dissonance. Would you mind kind of going into that a little bit?
Well, I was just saying that I think that, and this kind of goes back to black and white thinking, I think oftentimes, at least what I see is that more non-traditional believing clients can be very dismissive of more traditionally believing members. But oftentimes I think what they fail to see is that they're falling into the same type of black and white thinking that they're criticizing.
Right.
And that's true of all of us. You know, we tend to not like things that, you know, that we share traits of, you know, so things that bug me about another person, if I really look closely, maybe are, you know, something I'm struggling with. So those are things I think we need to be aware of, because like I said, even if you're not a believing person in a religious tradition, you're still having to face cognitive dissonance, you know, in other aspects of your life. And so this is not something that all of a sudden education is going to save you from. And sometimes I think it can leave believers or more traditional believers in the light of, well, they're naive, or they're not intelligent enough, or they're not willing to look at the hard issues. And I think that that's a very unfair assessment of our believing members in the church, and that you can have spiritual experiences that are very real and very personal and unique. And that those are valid. Those are valid to that individual. We don't have a right to disrespect that.
Yeah, absolutely. I just couldn't agree more that I think that kind of simple-minded thinking is immature, you know, is just as immature in either direction. I have a friend who was telling me about a relative of his who was always a kind of very orthodox member of the church, in the sense that was kind of maybe not very critical in his relationship to the church. And when Prop 8 came out, they kind of wholeheartedly went and knocked on doors and so on in California. And my friend was saying to them, you know, gosh, you know, I'm surprised that you're so willing to do that. And, you know, he was expressing some of his challenges to that pressure in the church to do that, but they did it anyway. Well, then recently they became disillusioned. My friend's relatives became disillusioned and they decided to leave the church. And now they were putting pressure on him, like, come on, let's go drink something. Let's go, you should have sex. That's no problem. So they're putting pressure in the opposite direction now, almost in an anti-Mormon way. And he was saying, you know, may you be more thinking, and they were expressing disbelief in their own willingness to be a part of the Prop 8 campaign and so on. And so he said, you know, may you be more thinking in your new orthodoxy than you were in your old one, which I thought was quite brilliant, because in the sense that we often don't want to think about the complexities of life. We want to just sort of adhere to a new identity, a new way of thinking, and sort of hope that it will give us the answers, rather than really tolerating the discomfort of discrepant ideas, discrepant experience, and not rushing in to judge it, you know, and you know, just that we're counseled in the church to not judge and to beware of pride, which I think are two elements, whether you're in the church or out of the church, that undermine our ability to make good, to really know truth, to really know what's right. Because we want so much to kind of assume we've got it, but I think it really sets us up to be simple in our thinking and to have too narrow perspectives on life.
This is particularly important in mixed faith marriages, yes. Because one of the founding principles of a healthy marriage is respect. And if you can't respect the person's, beliefs and ways of construing their world, then you're going to run into some really big hiccups for dealing with one another.
Right.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've had the privilege of, you know, in the past couple years, becoming really close friends with a lot of people who have left the church and, you know, sort of no longer find value in Mormonism. And these are some of the best people I know. But a lot of people that I've sort of had the opportunity to meet, I see exactly what both of you are talking about, where they sort of the same black and white sort of sucker's choice that caused them to leave Mormonism, they still use it in their ongoing ways of structuring their reality. Mm-hmm. And so kind of in a funny way, it's like you can take the Mormon out of the church, but sometimes you can't take the church out of the Mormon. You know what I mean? It's like it's so ingrained in us that we still sort of, hold on to that that mm-hmm. that paradigm. We just sort of tweak it.
mm-hmm. Yeah, or yeah, what I would say is immaturity is universal. meaning human beings, they want simple answers. They want certainty. They don't like anxiety. And I just think it's moral courage to tolerate it enough to keep adjusting how you engage in the world. But I do think that's, you know, we all do it.
Cool. Well, I think we've done a pretty good job of sort of addressing all of these issues. I think, you know, even though we sort of kind of went off in different directions here and there, I thought everything was really valuable, and I really appreciate both of you participating. Before we wrap up, is there any I'd love, you know, if there is a way to sort of tie this all together and make some final statements or suggestions for our listeners, if both of you wouldn't mind taking a turn and doing that, I think that'd be really useful in terms of a conclusion for us.
Sure. You know, Socrates, the unexamined life is not worth living. That while that's maybe a little bit of a harsh statement, that, you know, I do think that cognitive dissonance is what pressures us to examine our lives. And, you know, faith crises, I see them as a good thing, you know, and that it's really about how do we approach the crisis and, you know, how much integrity do we bring to it. And I think the where I'm often pushing my clients is to be really honest with themselves, to kind of face the discrepancies and to bring their best selves to them. And, you know, to ask yourselves the question of like, what really matters to me? And is this a belief that is helpful to me and makes me a better person, or, you know, a more grounded and compassionate person, or not? And, you know, can I adjust my beliefs and still hold to what I really value and hold to be true? And I think, you know, to just pressure ourselves to bring our best selves to that struggle. So those are my thoughts.
Yeah, I guess I'll close by just saying that, like Jennifer, I believe in universal truth. However, our individual ability to formulate and understand truth, I think, is greatly affected by many things. So my brain, my biology, my gender, my sexuality, my culture, my religion I grew up in, the country I live in, my politics. So truth, although universally kind of out there, is hard to understand. And I think that we become prideful when we think we've got a cornerstone to truth, or when we think that we have a lot of it figured out. And so although there are many what I find valuable truths in the gospel, as we understand it through the lens of Mormonism, I also think we need to be continually careful and vigilant to not be prideful and to not assume that we have it all right. And I guess that's just what I will close with.
Awesome. I love both of those statements. A few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to interview Nathaniel Givens, and he had written a series over at Times and Seasons about the concept of epistemic humility. And I think it's a great companion episode for our listeners to check out and sort of absorb. And it very much goes in line with what Natasha just said. And, you know, I think being epistemically humble as opposed to epistemically prideful is a great way for us to not dismiss cognitive dissonance, but incorporate it into our lives and use it as a tool to help us grow and to develop. And I think both of you have given our listeners great perspectives and tools in terms of how to balance ways of navigating cognitive dissonance in our lives. And I think this is a really great contribution. I thank you both for participating.
Thanks, Micah.
Yes.
So I think that basically wraps everything up. Again, this has been a collaborative production with A Thoughtful Faith and Mormon Mental Health. And I believe once we get this episode finished and edited, we will publish it on both podcasts. I think that's it. Ladies, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Night.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Over last tempestuous sea, chart and compass came from thee. Jesus, Savior, pilot me unknown way. Hiding rock and treacherous shore, chart and compass came from me. Jesus, Savior, pilot me. Thank you.
still is her child. Thou canst hush the ocean wild, wondrous sovereign of the sea. Jesus, Savior, pilot me, boisterous way. Obey thy will,
obey thy will.
When thou say,
fear not.